In somebody who's severely suffering from gambling disorder, lying becomes second nature.
This is Colin O'Gara, head of addiction services at St John of God's Hospital in Dublin.
But remember that Gamblers Anonymous and the 12-step programme is about honesty. It's about humility. It's about unravelling that antisocial behaviour. And one of the big questions within our field is chicken and egg. Do people become antisocial and almost psychopathic as a result of this disorder? Do they steal their child's communion money to gamble? Or, you know, have they been programmed? Is that them or is that the disease?
The thing is, when you do go back to gambling, it's, you don't just start again. You don't just walk in and place that 50 pence bet or whatever the case may be. Like, I remember my last bet when I stopped gambling around 91. I think my last bet might have been for 20 quid stakes, say. But I do remember my first bet in 2003 when I went back was 250 quid, I think. It's an illness that's progressive in you. It grows and grows and grows. It doesn't level off. It doesn't evolve or devolve, go back to the beginning. You don't. It lives. Like an alcoholic can't go back after 30 years and take one glass of vodka and go home. It's the same with me and gambling. I can't do it. I can't stop.
I would have went into manipulation mode immediately, because that's what I do when I gamble. I manipulate. So I also would micromanage people, shall we say, in relation to what I want them to know, what I want them not to know, etc., etc., right? Being in Dublin then, Monday to Friday, helped me a lot. My friends. I never gambled when I came home to Limerick at the weekend. Deliberately. Because I didn't want them knowing I was at it. My performance levels at work would have went through the roof because I needed more money. So I worked like you wouldn't believe. When I wasn't gambling, I had so many clients built up that you know, a couple of days a week, all I'd have to do is go in a couple of days a week, work those clients, get my figures up, away I go. But now I had this need for money, and I would be in the office at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd stay in the office till 6. Like my work ethic and my work levels would have completely gone up purely because I needed the money. Your self-respect starts to go again fairly quickly. You start to get sloppy from my appearance point of view. Like, I mean, I'd still always have the real fur coat and no knickers kind of thing, where you look the part on the outside but really inside there's nothing there. That would have been pretty true with me, you know. I'd still be jumping in the 5-series Beamer. I'd still be wearing the Calvin Klein, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, I wouldn't have a pot to piss in. But it never bothered me, because I was thinking, right, sure, if I ever run out, I'll just pull a stroke. I'll make money then when I gamble. I'll be able to repay the stroke, and then I'll have it's mental illness. But it took hold of me again very quickly. Very, very quickly. Like, there was no small bet here, small bet there, small bet here. This thing just took legs, went, and that was it.
From Wine Tavern Productions, in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler. Episode 5, Stinkin' Thinkin'.
When I went back gambling from around 2003 onwards, I could basically do what I wanted, and I did whatever I wanted, safe in the knowledge that if a guard comes knocking on my door or if someone I've ripped off comes looking for their money back, all I have to do is pick up the phone. Bill, I need this. Pay that for me. And he did.
Pat is talking about Bill Gavin, his old boss. We heard a lot about him in the last episode.
Without being big-headed, I was the best salesperson that he had. I made him a hell of a lot of money. And he would have been what's known in recovery circles as an enabler, because I knew I could run roughshod and do whatever I wanted and have him there as a backup. But having said that, I can't and I won't blame him for any of my problems. I was what I was long before I met him. He gave me a break that not everybody would have given me. I learned so much in that business from the day I went in to the day I left. I was there 21 years. I suppose it was like a bad marriage. You know, we were very good for each other and really, really bad for each other at the same time.
One of the things we looked for from Pat right from the start of this story was his list of convictions. We did eventually get it, quite a few months in. I remember getting the message from Pat on WhatsApp with the official PDF from the guards. It's a simple document just listing, you know, the act he was convicted under, the date and the location of that conviction, and the length of the sentence.
It's not a perfect document because there are sometimes large gaps between the time a crime is committed and the time that he's convicted for it. And because it just lists the law that he broke rather than the crime itself, it can be difficult to connect a particular conviction to a particular crime. That's something I had to go through with him in some detail.
Actually, one thing I was wondering about, which is January 3rd, 1991,
mm-hmm.
is that the one that's in there in 1993 on the list at Limerick City Circuit Court?
Doesn't seem to be on the list for some reason. I think I know what it is now. If you look at the 12th of the 10th, 93, Limerick Circuit Court,
mm-hmm.
that was the appeal of those charges. See, the sentence suspended for 10 months?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the 10 months that I got on the 3rd of January, 91.
Okay.
That I appealed, but it took almost 2 years for the appeal to be heard. That's what that is.
Okay. Just in the book, it says the appeal is in November of 1991.
It could well have been. I'm pretty sure it was, actually. Because that's the date is wrong in this.
Yeah, I guess these things...
12th, 10th, actually, that's a mistake. That should have been the 12th of the 10th, 1991. So I'd say that's a typo, that it should be the 12th of the 10th, 91.
The list of convictions does show us how quickly Pat's trajectory led him back to criminal behaviour. He says he went back gambling in late 2003. By March 2006, he was back in front of a judge again. The charge was making gain or causing loss by deception.
So Portlaoise is 2006.
Mm.
What's going on there?
I'd actually been offered a job by a radio station. I was just about gambling again. I was fighting with my boss because I was starting to act the bollocks again and things like that. So I decided, you know what? I'll teach him a lesson. So I went and worked for this guy for a few months. Had gotten into my old habits again, and I started borrowing money off clients, off customers, off shops, giving them bullshit stories that, oh, my car broke down, I need petrol money home, getting 20 quid here and 50 quid there. Basically, a few of them reported me. It was investigated, got charged, got it over and done with, paid back the money, obviously, and they were all dealt with favourably.
And that was your first time... Was it your first time back in court since 1993?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I keep going back to the time frame here because I think it's really important. One major reason we wanted to see this document was to verify Pat's claim that he wasn't scamming anyone or doing anything illegal outside of the times when he was gambling. So he had this long period between 1991 and 2003 when he says he was clean. And while we can't rule out the possibility that the document we have was edited before it reached us, Pat's account does match up with that record. There are no convictions listed during that time. That said, we've heard the stories in the last episode about Bill Gavin and his business practices, and we heard from Kieran Ring that Pat was engaged in deception during this apparently clean period. We have to acknowledge that it's possible that Pat's scamming didn't exactly stop during that time. Maybe it was just being covered up by his job.
I was the golden cow. You know, I could literally do what I wanted there. And whenever I got into trouble or whenever something came up, I'd get a bollocking. And the bollocking would last 10 minutes or maybe an hour. But then I knew that it'd be all forgotten about because I'd go out, do my job, probably make him 20, 30, 40 grand in a couple of days. And he'd be thrilled. He didn't care. Yeah. So like I said, it was the enabling thing. He was prepared to overlook all these things because I was making him so much money. But that was my way of justifying things to myself too. That's wrong. Like, I mean, that's me kind of not blaming him, but kind of using him as an excuse. Like, I used him more than he ever used me. It was a very healthy, unhealthy relationship.
So maybe he was still ripping people off, but Bill Gavin was there bailing him out, meaning it never escalated to having the guards and the courts involved. According to Pat, that was certainly the case after 2003, when he was gambling again. But I suppose we've always wondered about the years before that. Did the scamming really stop when the gambling stopped? Do they always go together, or is it possible to separate one from the other?
One of the big questions within our field is chicken and egg.
Here's Colin O'Gara again. You heard him at the beginning of the episode. He's one of Ireland's leading experts when it comes to gambling addiction.
Do people become antisocial and almost psychopathic as a result of this disorder? Do they steal their child's communion money to gamble? Or, you know, have they been programmed? Is that them or is that the disease? And in the vast majority of cases, there's no doubt in my mind that it is people behave in that way as a consequence of their addiction. And people should not be stigmatized as a result of what they have done in the context of their addiction. Because everybody who's been addicted behaves in an antisocial way on some level to maintain their addiction. It doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't mean that they're antisocial people. That's so important to me, Nicola, to get that message out in terms of, you know, because I you know, stigma in terms of my patient population being stigmatized and me myself being stigmatized for working in the area. You know, it's so...
Why? Because people just see them as liars and as bad?
Yeah, it's a deficit of will, of personality. You're wrong on some level. You're broken and wrong and not to be untrustworthy, deceptive, malignant in some way, you know? So this is like juggling 100 balls in the air at once. And the presentation is that the balls all fall down all at once. That is the disease. It's about keeping all the balls in the air. But at some point, it all comes crashing down. So it is building up a house of cards in relationships, with work, with your public persona, with everything. There are people out there at the moment, public people, people in the community, people that your listeners will know, but don't know that they're suffering from severe gambling disorder. It's only when it breaks.
So, you know, it crashes and people either will come into, you know, a doctor's surgery, present whatever, or else they'll apologise. Maybe the financial situation can be fixed by a relative, money paid back, and they start juggling again.
Mm. Or not.
Or not. Which is what I was going to ask you. Is it, can they stop?
Without a doubt, yeah. So the figures would support, you know, an abrupt cessation, probably in about a third of people, okay? And you're going to have a relapsing, remitting picture then in a further third. And unfortunately, another third is going to suffer long-term, ongoing, severe, and can't get a grip on it, really. So in treatment services, we find ourselves interfacing with all of the above, all of those outcomes. And it's fantastic, obviously, as a clinician to be able to treat somebody and they get well. Everybody's happy, family's happy, patient's happy. The relapsing, remitting piece, it's difficult. So somebody relapses, the family are very upset. Obviously, looking at ourselves in terms of, and did we get it wrong or could we have done more?
We haven't really been able to speak to Pat's family, but I have to imagine that's a thought they've had many times over the years. Could we have done more? It's one of the aspects of this story that I find so interesting. Like when Pat is in the midst of his relapse, what's going through the minds of the people around him? The people who know him best, his family, his friends, his workmates. Did they notice when things were starting to go wrong again? Were they wondering how they could step in, how they could help? Did they ignore the signs? Did they take advantage of him? Despite our best efforts, we haven't been able to talk to the people who could answer these questions. I wish we had those answers because I feel like people who find themselves in similar situations today might find them useful, or at least comforting in some way. But that's an issue we'll have to return to later. For now, let's just say that Pat's criminal record began to grow very quickly after he went back gambling in 2003. For the next 6 or 7 years, He was constantly scamming people, ripping people off, lying to people, and deceiving them. And all the while trying to hide his increasingly out-of-control gambling from everyone around him. He was, to use Colin O'Gara's words, juggling 100 balls in the air at once. It was only a matter of time before it all came crashing down around him.
My boss, he had a business account with the Bank of Ireland and the IFSC. And I knew the guy, his relationship manager, I knew the name of this guy because he'd be on the phone to him a lot or whatever have you. I remember he was doing deals on property that he owned, that he was selling, and he needed to get bridging loans and things like that. And then I was just thinking, Jesus, they're throwing money at everyone here. So I literally introduced myself to this guy. It was easy for him to verify who I was, who I worked for and all that kind of stuff. And sure, I told him I had a house in England that I was selling. Might be a while before I get the money over, but blah, 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 usual kind of stuff. And quite literally, he threw himself at me. Is there anything I can do for you? Do you need anything in the meantime? I said, a small overdraft will do me. Give me $2,000. Had that gambled within a couple of days. Next thing, I said, fuck it, I'll chance my arm here. Rang him up. Oh, threw another $3,000 in on top of it. And then it just kept going over the next couple of weeks where he was up to about 10.5. And then he probably began to twig, Jesus, there's something going on here. I'd say I had the whole lot withdrawn in the space of maybe up to 2 weeks max. And like, it would have been completely irregular because all they would have seen on the would have been transactions. And the more I think about it now, if I just went into a bank back then and asked him for a loan, they'd have given it to you because they were throwing money at everyone back then. If I went to him initially and said, I need $20,000, he'd have given me the $20,000. But you see, I thought, I'll only chance I'll get two, that'll be grand. And then when I saw how easy it was to get the two, I was asking for $3,000 and then I was asking for another $2,000. And that was strange. I mean, that had set off alarm bells in anyone's way of thinking, I would imagine. And he reported it. He went over to Store Street and reported it. Like, everything about it was legal, apart from the lie about the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a genuine account in my name. I didn't tell him any lies about where I worked, what I earned, all that kind of stuff. That was all done perfectly legally. But the lie was about the property that existed that I was supposed to be selling for $400,000 and blah, 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 and all this money will be coming over. I had done this kind of thing before to banks on a smaller scale for a couple of $100 here and a couple of $100 there years previously. Like, and I did it pretty safe in the knowledge that they're not going to come after me for this because they won't like the publicity of being fucked over.
Mm.
And that was still my mentality with this crowd. They're not going to like this. They're not going to want the publicity of this. But in this instance, they didn't care. I mean, I'm sure that when they rang the guards, or if they rang the guards, or if they made inquiries themselves, like, I presume when banks have investigators, I mean, I'm sure that they did a little bit of digging. They found out, Jesus, he's got a history. And the fact that my employer was a very good client of theirs at the time, like, he'd been involved, he was involved in a property deal with them that was worth millions, like, which was another reason why I didn't think they'd ever come after me. They might be saying, we'll sweep this under the carpet. Like, it was just me thinking I could manipulate the whole thing. And when I was charged, when I was brought to the circuit court, that was one of the main conditions, that when I went back to court 6 months or 9 months later or whatever the case may be, that it was repaid. Like, if that money wasn't repaid, I would have got the 4 years.
And how did you repay it?
I basically saved most of my wages between March and November.
And no gambling then?
There was gambling, but there wasn't as much. I could be very disciplined if I had something to do and if I needed to do it. And this was big, like, there was a huge imminent threat here of me going to jail.
In the 6 months between his arrest and his court date, Pat somehow managed to curb his gambling habit and repay the money to the Bank of Ireland. And in a further attempt to win favour with the judge, he attended treatment for his gambling addiction, just like he had way back in 1991. In fact, he returned to the very same treatment centre he'd been in before.
You know, I was in this place 19 years previously. You know, and having to go back there, yeah, it wasn't my proudest moment, but, you know, I'd like to say that I did it for wanting to change my life or wanting to stop gambling at the time, but I didn't. You know, I did it. I did it purely and utterly to get the letter to impress the judge.
How different was it for you to be back there this time? Just because the first time you were there, you're 21, 22.
Yeah.
you know, to come back at 40.
41, yeah.
You're a very different person at that stage.
Yeah, I was. But again, even then, like, the arrogance was going through the roof. Sure, I was there. I've been here before. I'll be able to run this my way. And I did, to a degree. Like, to a degree, I was able to manipulate group sessions to make it look like I was doing everything that needed to be done. Like, I had a counsellor. One of the counsellors, I had to do a step one, it's called, where you kind of write a summary of your addiction and how you've been and all that kind of stuff. And sure, I did a brilliant one. Like, the rest of the fellas there, barely able to put two words together, but sure, I was able to write this lovely, eloquent piece or whatever. And the first thing counsellor said was, in front of the whole group, sure, look, this is the way to do it. Do it like Pat does it. And automatically I could feel the head kind of going, you know. So even then, like, even when I wasn't consciously trying to manipulate a situation, I was manipulating it.
Was there any point within that 4 weeks that you started to engage with it more sincerely, or?
Yeah, there was. A funny thing kind of happened. There was no real, and there still is no real gambling program in those places. So you're kind of following an Alcoholics Anonymous program or a Narcotics Anonymous program. And I, again, went to AA meetings on Sunday mornings in the house. Public AA meetings, people come in, ex-residents and all that kind of stuff. And I was sitting in the back of the room, just literally, again, paying lip service. And a woman started talking. And I looked up, and there she was, a woman that I had a flame and row with 19 years previously, where she let her remote control fly at my head. And I just couldn't believe it, because if I had to write any woman off, I'd have had her written off straight away, because she was a train wreck 19 years previously. Like, I'd have said, she's going to go out, drink again, and be dead within 6 months. And there she was, 19 years later, looking better than she did 19 years previously, and sober as a judge all that time. And that really kind of impressed me. Like, when you see people like that, when you're in treatment centres or recovery rooms, most of the time you'll find someone and you look at them and you say, Jesus, I'd love to have what they have. And I got that from her.
And how did that change your own behaviour, like, within the treatment?
I suppose I just started to take it a bit more seriously, you know, and maybe give myself a little bit of credit and say, right, you know, maybe you can do it right. You know, you've done it before, you've made mistakes, but I don't consider myself to be a bad person. I think I'm a good person that's done a lot of bad things. I don't think I'm a bad person. But just trying to convince yourself of that, sometimes it's hard, because you look back at the things you've done, and, like, the things I've done are so fucking ridiculous. Ridiculous. Petty, small, stupid shit. And a lot of it, like. And it is all about self-respect too. I had no respect for myself. I thought I did, but I had none. My appearance alone should have told me that, like, you know, the way I'd let myself go. No, I genuinely didn't care. And I started to care in there for a while, you know, and I did for a few years after I came out of it too.
Do your family understand it's an illness?
My parents didn't. They just could never get their heads around it. And that's a generational thing, I suppose. They're very respectable people. They have respectable careers, great families. Never, ever, ever in a million years would they ever be involved in anything illegal. And all my fuck acting over the years and publicity that I got as a result of it has had a very detrimental effect on them, you know. They didn't deserve it, you know. They don't deserve any of it. My mother never, ever, ever understood it. She never understood the addiction. She never understood treatment. She never understood anything. All I ever had to do to make my mother happy was be happy myself and not have guards knocking on her door.
And I would have manipulated my mother a lot. You know, insofar as if I needed something, I'd go and tell her, and I'd go and talk to her, and I'd go, ma'am, you're the only one I can talk, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, I really did. I could always manipulate her, you know. And
I'm sad to say I did. You know, a lot. Because I suppose it was something that they didn't understand. It was something that they didn't know how to deal with. You know, I am the black sheep, literally, like, of the family, you know. And I suppose it's hard for them to comprehend it. It's hard for them to look in and look at me doing it. I'm bringing huge amounts of shame to them, you know. I'm hurting them. I don't seem to care about it. You know, that's the way it looks.
My father, God love him, he knew everything. And he did everything he could to help me. Everything he could. And I broke the man's heart more times than I could count.
It was around June 2012, maybe May, June 2012. I was at home and I noticed that he wasn't feeling too good. Like, he was still a young man still. Like, this was 2012. He would have been 67. They found that he had a tumour in his bile duct, which is a particularly nasty, awkward place to get one by all accounts. But we were kind of hopeful that it was something that they'd gotten early and that they might be able to do something about it. And I wasn't gambling at that stage. I was a couple of years into it again. I was in a good place with all that kind of stuff. So I was able to take a step back and do whatever work I needed to do from home. So I decided I'll go home and I'll be there as much as I can. It kind of progressed pretty quickly with him. He got very sick very quickly. And it went on for a long time. Like, I'd say he struggled the bones of 16, 17 months with this. And it was tough. You know, it wasn't easy to live with that, you know, to look at him deteriorate in front of you for as long a period of time as it took. I remember I got a phone call 1:30 in the morning, basically saying, look, how quickly can you get here? Like, it's happening. It's Halloween 2013. I got in there about 3:30. And my mother, my sisters, my uncle, Dan, a couple of other lads, all inside in the room. And he died at 4:25. We'd gone through the ringer. We'd gone from hating each other to being best friends, you know. And I was kind of at a point. I was at a point with him where I was doing well again, and he could see that I was doing well. And I could see how proud it made him, you know. And that's what kind of made it so hard, I think, you know. It brought up a lot for me because it just reminded me of all the shit that I put him through. All the times he had to bail me out, all the times he had to make excuses for me. And I never really appreciated him until the last few years where we started to kind of patch things up.
At the same time, you know, that had happened at a time when you were not gambling and you were, you know, living the way that you wanted to live.
I'm really, really grateful for that, because if I was gambling around that time, I really don't know what I would have done. Like, I wouldn't have been able to have been there as much as I was and to try and do as much as I just felt that the fact that I wasn't gambling meant that I was able to do things for him that I wouldn't have been able to do if I was. So at least I have that. You know, I can look back and I can say I did everything that I could have done for him. And I think he was proud of me when he died.
I'm not sure I grieved my father properly. I don't think I did. I don't know. Yeah, I suppose then I just started to develop the why does God treat me like this kind of attitude, you know? I mean, I was thinking to myself, Jesus, I've done everything I can possibly do over the last 3.5-4 years. I've done everything I need to do. I've done my recovery properly. I've been clear from gambling. I've been doing all the right things, you know? And I had always
been of the opinion that when I was doing all those things that life would get really, really, really good. And it didn't, you know. Life was probably as bad then, I'd say, as it ever was. And I just started to lose faith in it. I suppose I started to lose faith in myself. And deep down, I just knew where I was going to end up.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.